I want to talk about commitment today, and almost every study that we see and just our own subjective sense of things suggests that commitment is going down in almost every area of life, right? That we just find people less and less committed to marriages, to romance, to jobs. Employers are talking about a lack of commitment from their employees. To church, there's a declining commitment. We just find that people are less and less committed. People won't sign long-term contracts for phones or for gym memberships or anything like that. And a good illustration of the declining commitment is found in, if you compare traditional wedding vows with contemporary wedding vows. How many of you saw all or part of the royal wedding last week? Any of you see the royal wedding? And if you look at Harry and Meghan's vows, I call them Harry and Meghan because they're friends. But if you look at Harry and Meghan's vows, here's what Harry said. I, Harry, take you, Meghan, to be my wife, to have and hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish till death us do part. According to God's holy law, in the presence of God, I make this vow. Now, Meghan gave the same vow, and it's a vow that I'm going to stick with you until I die. That was the traditional vow. Let me read to you actual examples of contemporary vows. They're different than this. And I'm going to ask if you can spot the difference, okay? Here's one vow. I promise to always leave the lights on in the bathroom. I promise to mysteriously take 3 hours to make a simple omelet. I promise to create a life of unexpected and strange adventures. I promise that I'll love you. How about this vow? I promise to you to always laugh with you and never go to bed angry, to comfort you in times of sorrow, including rough Buckeye, Blue Jackets, and Bengal seasons. Actual wedding vow. How about this? I believe that me time is an actual concept. It can be proven by science. I believe that carefully folded socks make you happy. Can you imagine something more vacuous than that? I believe that there's no time or place I'm more content than when you're close. Because of this and so much more, I believe I will always love you. And then there were the famous Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston vows. Those of us who get, you know, subscription to People and We and all of that, right? And maybe you read these vows. Brad promised to split the difference on the thermostat. And Jen promised always to make your favorite banana milkshake. Isn't that sweet? So I've been doing a series called Love is More Than Just a Feeling. Love is more than a feeling. You know, our feelings go up and down. You know, your feeling in a romance, at some points you may feel incredibly warm, incredibly romantic, and other times you may feel cold or hurt. Your feelings toward your extended family, toward your own parents or your siblings or your kids go up and down. Your feelings toward church may go up and down, right? Our feelings go up and down, and they're not the foundation for love. If you really strip away everything and you get to the roots of love, love is always based upon a commitment. It's based on a choice. I'm committing to loving you regardless of how I feel in the moment. And love at its essence, love at its core, is more than a feeling. Love is a committed choice. That's what I want to talk about today. Let's invite God's presence and we'll turn to His Word. Let's pray. Lord, we need you and we need your presence. I welcome you here, dear God, and just invite you to be present with each and every person who's listening to this message today. I pray, God, for those whose commitments are hanging by a thread, that you might encourage, that you might strengthen, that you might assist us to hang in. For those who fear commitment, Lord, you know. I pray for confidence and courage and strength. I ask, Lord, that your word would have its intended effect, that we'd become better followers of your son, Jesus. Well, please, Lord, fill me in Jesus' name. Amen. So I'm looking at Ruth chapter 1. One of the most beautiful little books in the whole Bible is the book of Ruth. It's a lovely, really elegantly written book. And here's what we read. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. And just by way of background, you need to know that in Jewish synagogues, even to this day, the book of Ruth is read on the holiday that Christians call Pentecost. We Jews, we call it Shavuos, the Feast of Weeks. And Shavuos, the Feast of Weeks, was always a holiday in which Jews celebrated their calling to share the blessings of God's covenant with the world. The holiday of Pentecost is a holiday of inclusion, where the nations are included in God's covenant with Israel. And when the rabbis were putting together the cycle of reading for synagogues, what they did was, and they had a cycle of reading just like churches. Many churches have a cycle of reading. Mainline churches do that. Catholic churches do that. Synagogues do the same. When they put together the yearly cycle of readings, they said that the book of Ruth really demonstrates God's heart for the world, because a Moabite woman was included in the people of Israel. And in fact, Ruth became the ancestor of Israel's greatest king, David, and of course, the ancestor of the greater king, Jesus, the Jewish Messiah. So, let me read to you again from the first few verses. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, so a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. They went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons, and we found out they also died. Now we read in these verses about a man named Elimelech. Let me camp with him. Elimelech is a man who ran from his commitments. Elimelech is a man who ran from his commitments. Now, it's apparent that the author of the book of Ruth wants us to attribute meaning to the various names that the author lists. And you must understand that in the ancient world, but particularly among ancient Jews, names were very significant. Parents didn't pick a name by going through baby books and trying to find a cool name and change the spelling so it would be different and novel. They didn't pick names because the name sounded good to them. A name communicated something of a person's character. A name communicated a person's essence. To know a name was to know the person. A name in the Bible often communicated that person's destiny or their calling. And it's very clear that Elimelech didn't live up to his name. Elimelech, El in Hebrew means God, Li means my, and Melech means king. And Elimelech's name literally means God is my king. Elimelech had the name, but he didn't have the game. He had the right label, but the medicine bottle was empty. We would say that Elimelech talked the talk, but he didn't walk the walk. His name communicated to the whole world, God is my king, I rely on him. But when push came to shove and Elimelech was under pressure, he didn't rely on God. He ran away from the promised land and he went to the land of Moab. It's really clear in light of Elimelech's own death, as well as the death of his two sons, that the author is expressing disapproval regarding Elimelech's choice to go to Moab. Do you understand what's going on here? Here's a man who is experiencing great difficulty, but instead of turning to God and relying on God and his generosity, he flees to a foreign people and is forced to rely on their generosity and on their God's generosity. Now, we're not that far away from Elimelech, are we? When we're under pressure, when push comes to shove, do we say, I'm going to be wholly committed to you, Lord? Or is this the time that I need to cut corners? I need to compromise. I can't just go the Christian route all the way, man. That doesn't work. I got to be realistic here. I got to have some other, you know, possibilities going. And if it means compromise, if it means that this line becomes dotted, if it means that I need to cut corners, if I got to lie on my resume, if I've got to, you know, lie about the house that I'm selling, well, that's what you need to do. We break our commitments. Why do we, like Elimelech, run from our commitments? Let me tick off four reasons why I think that we struggle with commitments. Here's the first reason. We struggle with commitment because we like to keep our options open. One of the problems people have with commitment, we like to keep our options open. We don't want to feel trapped. We don't want to feel caged in. We enjoy the feeling of freedom. We don't want to be nailed down. And it might be that, you know, if we commit over here, something better will come along. Someone better may come along. And keeping options open is appropriate, I think, for one stage of life when you're young, when you're inexperienced, when you're exploring. And so instead of, you know, I'm going to marry the first boy I ever talked to, it's appropriate for girls to date a lot of different boys to figure out, what do I like? Who do I value? It's appropriate for boys to date a number of girls and to say, you know, I've got to find myself. I need to figure out what I even enjoy, who I am, who they are. When you're young, when you're inexperienced, it's appropriate to keep your options open. But the keep your option open mentality as we age contains with it a fatal flaw. And the fatal flaw is that the good life is found not by settling down, by making a commitment, by making a choice, but always going after this ideal of freedom. The truth is that the good life, the life that all of us really want, is found by us saying no to many good things so we can say yes to the best thing. That's what makes life work. So at some point, I want to say yes. You know, the purpose of searching is so that you find, not that you continue on the search forever. We live in an age where people never want to find. So many folks call themselves spiritual, but not religious. I'm on a search. It's good that you're on a search. But at some point, what if you find? Are you going to continue to be on the search? I want to suggest to you that there's someone at the end of the road of the search. His name is Jesus. And he calls himself the way, the truth, and the life. He came to offer abundant life. At some point, we say, this is the person I'm going to commit myself to. This is the thing I'm going to commit myself to. You know, to enjoy the fruit of a long-term relationship means that we make a commitment. Yes, there's a million fish in the sea, but I'm going to land on one. I'm going to say no to the many, many men that I could have hooked up with. I'm going to say yes to this man. I'm going to say no to the many, many women I could have hooked up with. I'm going to say yes to this woman. And I find folks do the same thing with church. You know, there's hundreds of good churches in every city. You know, that church has, oh, it's amazing. They've got smoke machines, you know, and the music's really loud, and there's lots of glitz, and that other church has the best gospel choir in the city, and this other church has the best youth pastor or the best preacher, or I like their coffee, or whatever it is. And at some point, if you're going to enjoy the fruit of a church, which is, you know, deep relationship and a deep sense of connection with the people and the heart of the church, you have to make a commitment to one place. You let go of the 10 others. You make a commitment to one place in one church, and you throw your lot in there. Why do people struggle with commitment? We struggle with commitment because we want to keep our options open. And second, we struggle with commitment because we think we must make a perfect decision. Perfectionists, you know, people with perfectionist tendencies really struggle making a commitment because even though they find, say, a romance with, you know, a guy or a gal with 40 great qualities, there's that one thing that's not right, that one flaw, and so I'm going to look for the perfect man or the perfect woman. I'm going to look for the perfect job or the perfect church. And so instead of finding a really good partner to do life with, not a perfect partner, but a really good one, instead of finding a really good church to go to, instead of landing at a really good job and making a career in that place, they're on an eternal search for the perfect place, the perfect job, the perfect fit. And you know what those folks end up with? Nothing. Because perfection in this broken, fallen world doesn't exist. We're always making trade-offs. No one is perfect, and no situation is perfect. And, you know, I see that as a pastor in people's commitment to church. Here's the typical pattern. People come to church, and for a while, they go through this honeymoon period where everything is amazing. This is so much better than my last church. It is incredible. I love everything. I love your carpet. I just love everything. It's just glorious. And then after the honeymoon period is over, they discover this one thing that they don't like. You know, the people in our small group are kind of cliquish. Or somebody said something insensitive to me, or the children's ministry worker wasn't so welcoming to my child, or, you know, I really didn't like that last sermon. Just didn't meet my standard. Or I don't like the worship music or something. And so they discover the flaw, and I'm going to take my kids and leave. And I'm going to go to another church that is amazing, and they go through the honeymoon again. And then they discover the flaw. And then they take their kids and they go on again. And you just keep repeating the cycle because there is no perfect church. There just isn't. There are really good churches, but there's no perfect church. And like there's no perfect people. And even if there was a perfect church, the moment you came, it would be ruined. So we struggle with commitment because we like to keep our options open. And we struggle with commitment because we think we have to make a perfect decision. And we struggle with commitment because we haven't resolved past hurts. There is an old saying that goes that a cat that sits on a hot stove and gets burned won't sit on a cold stove either. And if you've been burned in a relationship, you've been burned in marriage or romance, or you've been burned at a church, it's very difficult to open yourself up again and make a new, fresh commitment to just be vulnerable again and say, okay, I'm going to try again. And until past hurt is resolved, many, many people can't make new commitments. Do you know this one, by the way? Have any of you ever been burned in a relationship and then struggled to like, okay, I'm going to try again? And maybe some of you, your marriages are hanging by a thread. And you say, gosh, I've tried to resolve this conflict with my spouse. It hasn't worked. Am I really going to try again? Well, we tried counseling and that counselor wasn't good. Am I really going to do what it takes to go to another counselor? Really? You know, I tried church and the church was so disappointing. Maybe it was positively corrupt. Maybe there was all kinds of financial, you know, mismanagement, finagling, or sexual, corruption or whatever. So we struggle with commitment. Frequently, it's just wounds from the past that keep us from being able to say yes to God's new blessing, to the new thing that God wants to give us. And let me just tick these off. We struggle with commitment because we want to keep our options open. We struggle with commitment because because we think we need to make a perfect decision. We struggle with commitment because we haven't resolved past hurts. And we struggle with commitment because we experience pressure or hardships. And this brings us right back to Elimelech. Elimelech ran from his commitment to the living God, to the God of Israel, because he was under pressure. There was a famine in the land. And so he said, I've got to find something else that's going to work because God right now is not working for me. And I think that in America right now, we are so much like Elimelech. We run from commitments. And part of the reason we run from our commitments is because we experience pressure and we have become incredibly fragile. You know, there is this basic philosophy that runs through American culture, especially now, that wasn't true in ages past. And the basic philosophy is that if there's something hard in my life, that's abnormal. That life should be easy. Life should be smooth. Life should not contain as many bumps as it does. And because the road is really bumpy, something is wrong. That it's abnormal to have stress in your marriage. Or it's abnormal to have a family member get desperately ill. Or it's abnormal to not have all the money that you want so that you can spend it on what you want. I can't tell you over the years how many people have come to me complaining about something in their life, and I'm not minimizing the complaint because sometimes life is really hard. But sometimes the underlying assumption is that there's something abnormal about this difficulty. And the truth is found both in all of human history, but also in the Bible, that life is hard. And life is supposed to be hard in a fallen, broken world. Life is hard. It is normal to have stress with your extended family, especially your parents, your siblings, your children, That is not abnormal, that's normal. It is normal to deal with ridiculous bureaucracy. It is normal to have equipment break down and technology not work. It is normal to not have all the money you want to spend it on whatever you want it on. It's normal to be hassled on your job. It's normal to have dissatisfaction in romance. It's normal to experience differences and relational conflict in church. It's normal to not like a sermon. It's normal to be tired on Sunday morning. It's normal to have a child that says, I don't need to go to church. I'm 12 years old and I can do what I want. That's not a time to throw in the towel and go, wow, things are so crazy. I'm so tired. I'm not going to make a commitment. Those things are normal. Jesus tells us this in a verse that we need to put on our refrigerator and claim. He says, I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In me you will have peace. Look at the contrast. In this world you will have trouble. Claim that. In this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I've overcome the world. And listen. We run because we experience pressure. You know, I see this fantasy all the time as people think, well, if I just move, my problems will go away. I'm just going to move. I'm going to move out of this neighborhood, or I'm going to move from Central Iowa. I'm just going to move. I'm going to go to California. But you know, here's the problem. Whenever we move, we take ourselves with us. And all of your own stuff is still there. All the patterns of your relational, you know, dysfunction, all of your addictions, your anxiety, your depression, it's still there. And when you get to California, the prices are higher. And there's more traffic. And you have a danger of burning up in a wildfire. So don't go there. In fact, let me get more serious, let me give you a rule of personal growth. You know, if you want to grow as a human being, and I'm talking about, grow emotionally or grow spiritually, if you want to grow as a human being, the way you grow is never by running away. You never grow by running away. You always grow by staying put and facing the issue that you need to face. You've got to face it. You've got to deal with it. And so you don't grow by pretending you're not addicted, lying to everyone. You grow by being honest, by facing it, and doing the hard work of breaking free of this addiction. You don't grow by running from relational conflict. You grow by dealing with it. And it might have to engage the hard work of humility, of admitting fault or flaw or forgiveness and working through that and lots of personal hurt. It may involve having to get a counselor, and that's hard work. But we never grow by running. We grow by dealing with it. And we have to deal with our stuff here and now. Because, friend, I'll tell you, you're going to have to deal with it there and then. And typically, problems don't go away. They just get bigger. And so we screw up our courage and we say, okay, I've made a commitment. Here's where I'm going to deal with my stuff, to dig in. And this applies to your marriages. It applies to your workplaces. It applies to your relationships in church. It applies to your family. Well, I want to move away from Elimelech, a man who ran from his commitment, and talk for a moment about the woman from whom, this book is named for, a woman named Ruth. Ruth is a woman who keeps her commitments. And let me read to you from verses 14 to 18. At this, they wept aloud again, then Orpah, and Orpah is Ruth's sister-in-law. How many of you know, by the way, that Oprah Winfrey's was named for this woman? True. How many of you? Okay, two. Good. So you read people also. So Oprah Winfrey was named for this woman, Orpah, in the book of Ruth. That's the name on her birth certificate. But when she was growing up, apparently folks struggled to say Orpah and they called her Oprah. And so that's why she's known as Oprah. Just file that away. It's going to be really useful at some point in the future. So then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Now, Ruth is tested in her commitments. And there's lots of things that are tugging at her to cause her to break her commitment to Naomi. One is Naomi's own counsel. Naomi says to Ruth, "Ruth, Orpah, I've got nothing for you. If you stay with me, you're going to starve. I've got nothing. The only reasonable thing for you to do is to go back to your family." So she's tested by the counsel she gets. And she's tested by the model of her sister-in-law, Orpah. Orpah just says, "Yeah, okay, I'm going to throw in the towel." And Ruth is looking at her, "Well, why don't I do that?" And then there's something else that tests Ruth, and that is, I think there's always the tug of the familiar. You know this one? I mean, Ruth's culture, Ruth's family, Ruth's gods, Ruth's, you know, whole upbringing is drawing her back and saying, "Come on back, come on back. Don't stay with this new commitment. Come on back." I see this often with people who start off on some new venture. You know, maybe you know, you're a kid and you're going to college and it's away from your family and it's away from your friends and it's away from what's familiar, and you go to college, and most young people, the first few months, it's really hard. It's hard breaking in with a new set of friends. It's hard breaking in a new setting, and there's this tug. Maybe I should just leave, you know, this university in another city and just go back home. I know the people there and I know the patterns. Maybe I'll just go to community college. I've seen this with folks who start off at new jobs. And they say, "Gosh, it's so hard to break in here and everything is really uncomfortable. Maybe I should just go back to my old job. I had lots of reasons why I left, but at least that was familiar." The draw of the familiar. I see that triply so with those who are called to missions. You know, anyone who wants to fulfill God's call on your life to missions, it requires this breaking free of the attraction of the familiar. Because here's the deal. You know, if you move out of our city, you move to another country, you're reduced to kindergarten level immediately in every area. It's like, I don't know anything. I don't know how to talk the language, perhaps. I don't know what people laugh at. I don't know how they relate in the grocery store. I don't really understand anything. I don't have friends here. All of my friends are back home. And there's this drawback. That's why so few people can last on the mission field. And Ruth is one of those rare people that's able to resist. She resists the counsel of her mother-in-law, Naomi. Naomi is saying, "Throw in the towel. Forget it. Give up." And we have many people today who, you know, have their commitments tested because they're getting counsel. Maybe you're getting counsel from a counselor who says, "Just forget it. Give up on your marriage." And your friends are saying that. And you have family members go, just kick the bum out. Get rid of them. Leave. And then there's lots of people, lots of models like Orpah in your life. Like, they're leaving, so why shouldn't I leave? And there's the tug of the familiar. So how does Ruth keep her commitments despite all of these pressures pulling her away? How does she do it? We read that Ruth clings to Naomi. Here's what it says. At this they wept aloud. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. That word clung is an interesting one in the original Hebrew. It's the same word that we read in Genesis 2:24, the marriage of the first man and woman. Here's what we read. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The old King James Version said, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife. We often teach that to form a new marriage, you have to leave and you have to cleave. You have to leave your family of origin and you have to cleave to this other person. What does that word cleave mean? It means literally to be glued to be stuck to adhere to be united with. And Ruth says, that's what I'm doing. You're not going to be able to pry me away. Look at her vow. Look at her commitment. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. Now, every time I've read these words in the Bible, I have a really tender place in my heart for these words, because these are the words that my wife Marlene said to me at our wedding nearly 43 years ago. And that was her marriage vow. She took it from the book of Ruth. Marlene was an older woman of 20. And I was a young boy of 19. And she made this vow to me. And it's a comprehensive vow. What Ruth is saying, it's comprehensive. She says, where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. There's only two possible states of being, going or staying. And Ruth is saying, I'm sticking with you in all the activities of life. It doesn't matter what it is, I'm with you. And Ruth says, I'm with you in all your relationships. Your people will be my people. I'm buying your relationships, not only horizontally. Your God will be my God. I'm buying it horizontally. I'm buying it vertically. And then Ruth goes on and she says, not even death will separate us. I'm going to be buried next to you. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. And Ruth then underlines it all by calling a curse down on herself. She says, may the Lord deal with me ever so severely if even death separates me. You know, this is the essence of a marriage vow. Most people do not understand what a marriage vow is. Marriage vow involves all of life, but even more. Most people don't know that when they're making a marriage vow, they're not just promising this other person. A Christian who makes a marriage vow makes a promise to God. We're vowing to God, not just this other person. So, what enabled Ruth to do this? How do we make a commitment and keep it even with all the pressure to pull us apart? How do we do that? How have millions of people over the last three millennia followed in the footsteps of Mother Ruth and kept their commitments. Well, last thought, because they knew God, the source of commitments. God is the source of loving commitments. The way that Ruth kept her commitment to Naomi and the way that you and I keep our commitments is not because we grit our teeth. It's not because we're particularly tenacious people. We have willpower and those other people are weak-willed and they don't. That's not it at all. Ruth was trusting in a God who makes commitments. She put her hope in God. God is the source of loving commitment. God strengthens us to be able to hang in there when we want to quit. There is a word that's used of God 245 times in the Hebrew Bible. 245 times there is a Hebrew word attributed to God, and the Hebrew word is chesed. Chesed. Sometimes translated loving kindness, but it means enduring love. It means steadfast love. It means committed love. It means covenant love. Chesed is God's commitment that you can never break. When God makes a commitment to love you, you can't get him to not love you. It doesn't matter what you do. God will always love you. Always. Regardless, he will. He will. Because it wasn't you that elicited his love in the first place. It was God's choice, God's decision to set his love and affection on you. And so it's not your activity that keeps him loving you. God is faithful. He keeps his commitments. He's full of chesed. So let me close with this. There is a wonderful psalm, Psalm 136, that describes God's chesed, his enduring love. It's a 26-verse psalm, and 26 times in the psalm, we have the refrain, his love endures forever, because we are forgetful. So we need to hear the same thing 26 times before we might believe it, that his love endures forever. I'm going to read to you a few verses as I close from Psalm 136. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. Give thanks to the God of God. His love endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord of Lords. His love endures forever. Brothers and sisters, the way you decide to not throw in the towel, the way you hold on to the commitments, the way you're even open to making a commitment, is by tapping into the God who makes commitments to us, by putting your faith and hope not in people, not in things working out the way you want them to work out. You put your faith and hope in God who makes commitments to us. That's what strengthens our commitment. Why don't you stand?